The two identical young men had widely set eyes on squarish faces, intent expressions, furrowed brows. They were several years older than Leto. Their pale skin was an inevitable consequence of spending their lives underground. Between them, Kailia cleared her throat and looked at her brother. "Romber," she said, flashing a glance at the twins and at Leto, "you're forgetting your manners." Romber suddenly remembered his obligations. "Oh, yes. This is Leto Atreides, heir to House Atreides on Caladan. And these two are Keter and Demur Pilru. Their father is Ix's ambassador to Kaitain, and their mother is a guild banker. They live in one of the wings of the Grand Palais, so you might see them around." The young men bowed in unison and seemed to draw closer to Kailia. "We're preparing for guild examination in the next few months," one of the twins, Keter, said. "We hope to pilot a ship like that someday." His dark head nodded toward the immense vessel below. Kailia watched them both with a worried glint in her green eyes, as if she wasn't too sure about the idea of their becoming navigators. Leto was moved by the sparkle and eagerness he saw in the young man's deep brown eyes. The other brother was less social and seemed to be interested only in the activity below. "Here comes the navigator's chamber," Demur said. Below, a bulky black tank floated ahead on a cleared path, borne on industrial suspensors. Traditionally, guild navigators masked their appearance, keeping themselves hidden in thick clouds of spice gas. It was generally believed that the process of becoming a navigator transformed a person into something other than human, something more evolved. The guild said nothing to confirm or deny the speculations. "Can't see a thing inside," Keter said. "Yes, but there's a navigator in there. I can sense him." Demur leaned forward so intently, it seemed as if he wanted to fly through the metaglass observation window. When the twins both ignored her, intent on the ship below, Kailia turned instead to Leto and met his gaze with sparkling emerald eyes. Romber gestured down at the ship and continued his rapid commentary. "My father is excited about his new enhanced payload Highliner models. I don't know if you've studied your history, but Highliners were originally of Richesian manufacture. Ix and Richese competed with one another for guild contracts, but gradually we won by bringing all aspects of our society into the process. Subsidies, conscriptions, tax levies, whatever it took. We don't do things halfway on Ix." "I've heard you're also masters of industrial sabotage and patent law," Leto said, remembering what his mother had claimed. Romber shook his head. "Lies told by jealous houses. Vermilion Hells, we don't steal ideas or patents. We waged only a technological war against Richese and won without firing a single shot. But as sure as if we'd used atomics, we struck mortal blows against them. It was either them or us. A generation ago, they lost their stewardship of Arrakis at about the same time they lost their lead in technology. Bad family leadership, I guess." "My mother is Richesian," Leto said crisply. Romber flushed with deep embarrassment. "Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot." He scratched his tousled blonde hair just to give his hand something to do. "That's okay. We don't wear blinders," Leto said. "I know what you're talking about. Richese still exists, but on a vastly smaller scale. Too much bureaucracy and too little innovation. My mother's never wanted to take me there, not even to visit her family. Too many painful memories, I suppose. Though I think she hoped marrying my father might help restore Richie's fortunes." Below, the tank bearing the mysterious navigator entered an orifice at the front end of the Highliner. The polished black chamber vanished into the vessel's immensity like a gnat inhaled into the mouth of a large fish. Though she was younger than her brother, when Kailia spoke, her voice sounded more businesslike. The new Highliner program is going to be the most profitable of all time for us. Large sums will be pouring into our accounts from this contract. House Vernius will get 25% of all the salaries we save the Spacing Guild during the first decade. Overwhelmed, Leto thought back to the small-scale activities on Caladan. The Pundi rice harvest, the boats unloading cargoes from ships, and the dedicated cheers the population had hurled at the old Duke after the bullfight. Grating sirens sounded from speakers mounted throughout the huge chamber. Below, like iron filings flowing within magnetic field lines, the subvoid workers evacuated from all sides of the newly constructed Highliner. Up and down the ceilinged city, lights twinkled from other large observation windows in the stalactite towers. Leto could make out tiny forms pressed close to distant panes. Romber stood near Leto as the spectators around them fell into a hush.
"What is it?" Leto asked. "What's happening now?"
"The navigator is going to fly the ship out," the twin Kater said. "He'll take it away from Ix so it can begin its rounds," Demur added. Leto stared at the rock ceiling, the impenetrable barrier of a planetary crust, and knew this was impossible. He heard a faint, barely discernible humming. "Piloting such a vessel out isn't difficult. At least not for one of them." Romber crossed his arms over his chest. "Much easier than guiding a Highliner back into a confined space like this. Only a top-level steersman could do that." As Leto watched, holding his breath just like all the other spectators, the Highliner shimmered, became indistinct, then vanished entirely. The air inside the huge grotto reverberated with a loud boom from the sudden volume displacement. A tremor ran through the observation building, and Leto's ears popped. The grotto now stood empty, a vast enclosed space with no trace of the Highliner, just leftover equipment and a pattern of discolorations on the floor and walls and ceiling. "Remember how a navigator operates a ship," Demur said, seeing Leto's confusion. "He folds space," Kater said. "That Highliner never passed through the crustal rock of Ix at all. The navigator simply went from here to his destination." A few members of the audience applauded. Romber seemed immensely pleased as he gestured to the new emptiness below that extended as far as they could see. "Now we have room to start building another one." "Simple economics." Kylia glanced at Leto, then demurely flicked her eyes away. "We don't waste any time." The slave concubines permitted my father, under the Bene Gesserit Guild agreement, could not, of course, bear a royal successor. But the intrigues were constant and oppressive in their similarity. We became adept, my mother and sisters and I, at avoiding subtle instruments of death. From In My Father's House by the Princess Irulan. Crown Prince Shaddam's tutoring chambers in the Imperial Palace would have been large enough to house a village on some worlds. With total disinterest, the Carino heir brooded in front of his teaching machine while Fenring watched him. "My father still wants me to sit in training classes like a child." Shaddam scowled down at the lights and spinning mechanisms of the machine. "I should be married by now. I should have an imperial heir of my own." "Why?" Fenring laughed. "So the throne can skip a generation and go directly to your son when he reaches his prime, Shaddam was 34 years old and seemingly a lifetime away from becoming emperor. Each time the old man took a drink of spice beer, he activated more of the secret poison. But the Yinqi had been working for months, and the only result seemed to be increasingly irrational behavior. As if they needed more of that. That very morning, Elrud had scolded Shaddam for not paying closer attention to his studies. watch, and learn. One of his father's tedious phrases. Do as well as Fenring for once. Since childhood, Hasimir Fenring had attended classes with the Crown Prince. Ostensibly, he provided companionship for Shaddam, while he himself gleaned an understanding of court intrigues and politics. In academics, Fenring always did better than his royal friend. He devoured any bit of data that could help him increase his position. His mother, Chaula, an introspective lady-in-waiting, had settled into a quiet home and lived on her imperial pension after the death of the emperor's fourth wife, Habla. In raising the two young boys together while she attended the Empress Habla, Chaula had given Fenring the chance to be so much more, almost as if she had planned it that way. These days, Chaula pretended not to understand what her son did at court, though she was Bene Gesserit trained. Fenring was wily enough to know that his mother comprehended far more than her station suggested, and that many plans and breeding schemes had gone on without his knowledge. Now Shaddam let out a miserable groan and turned from the machine. "Why can't the old creature just die and make it easy for me?" He covered his mouth, suddenly alarmed at what he had blurted. Fenring paced the long floor, glancing up at the hanging banners of the Landsraad. The Crown Prince was expected to know the colors and crests of every great and minor house, but Shaddam had difficulty simply remembering all the family names.
"Be patient, my friend. All in its own time."
In one of the alcoves, Fenring struck a combustible spike of vanilla-scented incense and inhaled a long breath of the fumes. "In the meantime, learn about subjects that will be relevant to your reign. You'll need such information in the near future." "Stop making that noise, Hasimir. It's annoying."
Pray for over the remembrance of the inner blur of his archibald, not Malachi Rukadush did that, number after the Hilton and that's in the outfit and he search out in the help and there are mouth for well. No one out of a shower and that's the ass is gay and well was him. Charles and you know him but I'm not five grown up. Now he was more south grass fell and I'm not even in on the earth your vet. There's a more good cup being a much and it's it. Says that it was in the hour a month. And there's no use to get you the best night clock up in the Alps, get by her day, and the fault was. My days was, and there's my wrist and my old heat. If a salaf sends even in the Scots, and then that's it, so let's the fork is all in cast for zero, go from me, I said that, so. And any else was never know, I guess if you cast you off for zero, I can you know, not. Skin on east, blue rose, and it'll dust the heat, I end up.
Mean in the deep wastelands. Arrakis is the only known source of melange in the universe. Fenring curled his hand into a fist and brought it down with a hard thump on the milky marble plaz tabletop. But why? With all the Imperial explorers and prospectors and the huge reward House Carino has offered for generations, why has no one found spice anywhere else? After all, with a billion worlds in the Imperium, it must be somewhere else. A billion? Shaddam pursed his lips. Hasimir, you know that's just hyperbole for the masses. The tally I've seen is only a million or so. A million, a billion, what's the difference, My point is, if melange is a substance found in the universe, we should find it in more than one place. You know about the planetologist your father sent to Arrakis? Of course, parted kinds. We expect another report from him at any moment. It's been a few weeks since the last one. He raised his head in pride. I've made a point to read them whenever they arrive. From the curtained side room, they heard gasping and giggling. Heavy furniture sliding aside. Something overturning with a thump. Shaddam allowed himself a thin smile. The concubine was well trained indeed. Fenring rolled his large eyes, then turned back to the teaching machine. Pay attention, Shaddam. Spice is vital, and yet all production is controlled by a single house on a single world. The threat of a bottleneck is enormous, even with Imperial oversight and pressure from Choam. For the stability of the Imperium, we need a better source of melange. We should create it synthetically if we have to. We need an alternative. He turned to the Crown Prince, his dark eyes glittering. One that's in our control. Shaddam enjoyed discussions like this much more than the tutor's programmed learning routines. Ah, yes. An alternative to melange would shift the entire balance of power in the Imperium, wouldn't it? Exactly. As it is, Choam, the Guild, the Bene Gesserit, the Mentats, the Lansrad, even House Corino, all fight over the spice production and distribution from a single planet. But if there was an alternative, one solely in the hands of the Imperial House, your family would become true emperors, not just puppets under the control of other political forces. We are not puppets, Shaddam snapped. Not even my doddering father. He flicked a nervous glance at the ceiling, as if Kamais might be hidden there, though Fenring had already run thorough scans for observational apparatus. Long may he live. As you say, my prince, Fenring said without conceding a millimeter. But if we put the wheels in motion now, then you will reap those benefits when the throne is yours. He fiddled with the teaching machine. Watch and learn, he said in a creaking falsetto imitation of Elrood's ponderous pronouncements. Shaddam chuckled at the sarcasm. The machine displayed scenes of Ixion industrial accomplishments, all the new inventions and modifications that had been made during a profitable rule by House Vernius. Why do you think it is the Ixions can't use their technology to find a spice alternative? Fenring asked. They've been instructed time and again to analyze the spice and develop another option for us, yet they play with their navigation machines and their silly timepieces. Who needs to tell the exact hour on any planet of the Imperium? How are those pursuits more important than the spice itself? House Vernius is an utter failure as far as you are concerned. This tutoring machine is Ixion. The annoying new Highliner design is Ixion. So is your high-performance ground car and...
Off the point, Fenring said. I don't believe House Vernius invests any of its technological resources in solving the alternative spice problem. It is not a high priority for them.
Then my father should give them firmer guidance. Shaddam clasped his hands behind his back and tried to look imperial, flushed with forced indignation. When I'm emperor, I'll be certain people understand their priorities. Ah, yes. I will personally direct what is most important to the Imperium and to House Carino.
Fenring circled the teaching machine like a prowling Lhasa tiger. He plucked a sugared date from a fruit tray unobtrusively displayed on a side table. Old Elrood made similar pronouncements a long time ago, yet so far he hasn't followed through on any of them. He waved his long-fingered hand. Oh, in the beginning he asked the Ixions to look into the matter. He also offered a large bounty for any explorer who found even melange precursors on uncharted planets. He popped the date into his mouth, licked his sticky fingers, and swallowed the smooth, sweet fruit. Still nothing. Then my father should increase the reward, Shaddam said. He's not trying hard enough.
Fenring studied his neatly clipped nails, then raised his overlarge eyes to meet Shaddam's.
Or could it be that old Elrood the Ninth isn't willing to consider all the necessary alternatives?
He's incompetent, but not entirely stupid. Why would he do that?
Suppose someone were to suggest using the Bene Tlelax, for example, as the only possible solution.
Fenring leaned against a stone pillar to observe Shaddam's reaction. A ripple of disgust crossed the Crown Prince's face. The filthy Tlelaxu! Why would anyone want to work with them?
Because they might provide the answer we seek.
You must be joking. Who can trust anything that Tlelaxu say? He pictured the gray-skinned race, their oily hair and dwarfish stature, their beady eyes, pug noses, and sharp teeth. They kept to themselves, isolating their core planets, intentionally digging a societal ditch in which they could wallow. The Bene Tlelax were, however, true genetic wizards, willing to use unorthodox and socially heinous methods, dealing in live or dead flesh, in biological waste. With their mysterious yet powerful axolotl tanks, they could grow clones from live cells and golas from dead ones. The Tlelaxu had a slippery, shifty aura about them. How can anyone take them seriously?
Think about it, Shaddam. Are the Tlelaxu not masters of organic chemistry and cellular mechanics?
Fenric sniffed.
Through my own web of spies, I've learned that the Bene Tlelax, despite the distastes with which we view them, have developed a new technique. I have certain technical skills myself, you know, and I believe this Tlelaxu technique could be applicable to the production of artificial melange. Our own source.
He fixed his bright bird-like eyes on Shaddam's.
Or are you unwilling to consider all alternatives and let your father maintain control?
Shaddam squirmed, hesitating to answer. He would much rather have been playing a game of shield ball. He didn't like to think of the gnome-like men. Religious fanatics, the Bene Tlelax were intensely secretive and did not invite guests. Heedless of how other worlds regarded them, they sent their representatives out to observe and to make deals at the highest levels for unique bioengineered products. Rumor held that no outsider had ever seen a Tlelaxu woman. Never. He thought they must be either wildly beautiful or incredibly ugly. Seeing the Crown Prince shudder, Fenring pointed a finger at him.
Shaddam, don't fall into the same trap as your father. As your friend and advisor, I must investigate unseen opportunities. Put aside such feelings and consider the possible victory if this works. A victory over the Landsrad, the Guild, Choam, and the scheming House Harkonnen. How amusing to think that all the strings the Harkonnens pulled to gain Arrakis after the downfall of Richeese would be for naught. His voice became softer, infinitely reasonable. What difference does it make if we have to deal with the Tleilaxu? So long as House Corino breaks the spice monopoly and establishes an independent source. Shaddam looked at him, turning his back on the teaching machine. You're sure about this? No, I'm not sure, Fenring snapped. No one can be sure until it is done. But we must at least consider the idea, give it a chance. If we don't, somebody else will, eventually. Maybe even the Bene Tleilax themselves. We need to do this for our own survival. What will happen when my father hears about it? Shaddam asked. He won't like the idea. Old Elrud never could think for himself, and Fenring's Chomerki had already begun to fossilize his brain. The Emperor had always been a pathetic pawn, shifted around by political forces. Perhaps the senile vulture had made a deal with House Harkonnen to keep them in control of the spice production. It wouldn't surprise Shaddam if the young and powerful Baron had old Elrud wrapped around his little finger. House Harkonnen was fabulously wealthy, and their means of influence were legion. It would be good to bring them to their knees. Fenring put his hands on his hips. I can make all of this happen, Shaddam. I have contacts. I can bring a Bene Tleilax representative here without anybody knowing. He can state our case before the Imperial Court. And then, if your father turns him down, we might be able to find out who's controlling the throne. The trail would be fresh. Shall I set it up? The Crown Prince glanced back at the teaching machine that obliviously continued to instruct a non-existent pupil. Yes, yes, of course, he said impatiently, now that he had come to a decision. Let's not waste more time, and stop making that noise. It'll take a while for me to get all the pieces in place, but the investment will be worth it. From the next room came a high-pitched moan. Then a thin squeal of ecstasy built higher and higher until it seemed that the walls themselves must crumble. Our tutor must have learned how to pleasure his little pet, Shaddam said with a scowl. Or perhaps she's just faking. Fenring laughed and shook his head. That wasn't her, my friend. That was his voice. I wish I knew what they were doing in there, Shaddam said. Don't worry, it's all being recorded for your later enjoyment. If our beloved tutor cooperates with us and causes no trouble, we'll simply watch it for amusement. If, however, he proves difficult, we'll wait until after your father's been given this concubine for his own private toy. Then we'll show Emperor Elrud a glimpse of those images. And we'll have what we want anyway, Shaddam said. Exactly, my prince. The working planetologist has access to many resources, data, and projections. However, his most important tools are human beings. Only by cultivating ecological literacy among the people themselves can he save an entire planet. Pardet Kynes, the case for Bella Tejus. As he gathered notes for his next report to the Emperor, Pardet Kynes encountered increasing evidence of subtle ecological manipulations. He suspected the Freeman. Who else could be responsible out there in the wastelands of Arrakis? It became clear to him that the desert people must be present in far greater numbers than the Harkonnen stewards imagined, and that the Freeman had a dream of their own. But the planetologist in him wondered if they had developed an actual plan to accomplish it.
While delving into the geological and ecological enigmas of this desert world, Kynes came to believe that he had the power at his fingertips to breathe life into these sun-blistered sands. Arrakis was not merely the dead lump it appeared to be on the surface. Instead, it was a seed capable of magnificent growth, provided the environment received the proper care. The Harkonnen certainly wouldn't expend the effort. Though they had been planetary governors here for decades, the Baron and his capricious crew behaved as if they were unruly house guests with no long-term investment in Arrakis. As planetologist, he could see the obvious signs. The Harkonnens were plundering the world, taking as much melange as they could as quickly as possible, with no thought to the future. Political machinations and the tides of power could quickly and easily shift alliances. Within a few decades, no doubt, the Emperor would hand control of the spice operations to some other great house. The Harkonnens had nothing to gain by making long-term investments here. Many of the other inhabitants were also indigents, smugglers, water merchants, traders who could easily pull up stakes and fly to another world, a different boomtown settlement. No one cared for the planet's plight. Arrakis was merely a resource to be exploited, then discarded. Kynes thought the Freeman might have a different mindset, though. The reclusive desert dwellers were said to be fierce to their own ways. They had wandered from world to world in their long history, been downtrodden and enslaved before making Arrakis their home, a planet they had called Dune since ancient times. These people had the most at stake here. They would suffer the consequences caused by the exploiters. If Kynes could only enlist Freeman aid, and if there were as many of these mysterious people as he suspected, changes might be made on a global scale. Once he accumulated more data on weather patterns, atmospheric content, and seasonal fluctuations, he could develop a realistic timetable, a game plan that would eventually sculpt Arrakis into a verdant place. It can be done. For a week now, he had concentrated his activities around the shield wall, an enormous mountain range that embraced the northern polar regions. Most inhabitants settled in rocky, guarded terrain, where, he supposed, the worms could not go. To see the land up close, Kynes chose to travel slowly in a one-man ground car. He puttered around the base of the shield wall, taking measurements, collecting specimens. He measured the angle of strata in the rocks to determine the geological turmoil that had established such a mountainous barrier. Given time and meticulous study, he might even find fossil layers, limestone clumps with petrified seashells or primitive ocean creatures from the planet's much wetter past. Thus far, the subtle evidence for primordial water was clear enough to the trained eye. Uncovering such a cryptozoic remnant, though, would be the keystone of his treatise, incontrovertible proof of his suspicions. Early one morning, Kynes drove in his trundling ground car, leaving tracks on loose material that had eroded from the mountain wall. In this vicinity, all villages, from the largest to the most squalid settlements, were carefully marked on the charts, undoubtedly for purposes of Harkonnen taxation and exploitation. It was a relief to have accurate maps for a change. He found himself near a place called Windsack, the site of a Harkonnen guard station and troop barracks that lived in an uneasy alliance with the desert dwellers. Kynes continued along, rocking with the uneven terrain. Humming to himself, he stared up at the cliff sides. The putter of his engine served as a lullaby, and he lost himself in thought. Then, as he came over a rise and rounded a finger of rock, he was startled to encounter a small, desperate battle. Six muscular, well-trained soldiers stood in full Harkonnen livery, cloaked in body shields. The bravos held ceremonial cutting weapons, which they were using to toy with three Freeman youths they had cornered. Kynes brought the ground car to a lurching halt. The deplorable scene reminded him of how he had once watched a well-fed Lhasa tiger playing with a mangy ground rat on Seleucus Secundus. The satisfied tiger had no need for additional meat, but simply enjoyed playing the predator. It trapped the terrified rodent between some rocks, scratching with long, curved claws, opening painful, bloody wounds. Injuries that were intentionally not fatal. The Lhasa tiger had batted the ground rat around for many minutes, as Kynes observed through high-powered oil lenses. Finally bored, the tiger had simply bitten off the creature's head and then sauntered away, leaving the carcass for carrion feeders. By contrast, the three Freeman youths were putting up more of a fight than the ground rat, but they had only simple knives and still suits, no body shields or armor. The desert natives had no chance against the fighting skills and weaponry of Harkonnen soldiers. But they did not surrender. The Freeman snatched at the ground and threw sharp rocks with deadly aim. But the projectiles bounced harmlessly off the shimmering shields. The Harkonnens laughed and pressed closer. Out of sight, Kynes climbed from his ground car, fascinated by the tableau. He adjusted his still suit, loosening binders to give him more freedom of movement. He made sure the face mask was in place, but not sealed. At the moment, he didn't know whether to observe from a distance, as he had done with the Lhasa tiger, or whether he should aid in some way. The Harkonnen troops outnumbered the Freeman 2-1, and if Kynes came to the defense of the youths, he would likely find himself either wounded or at least charged with interference by Harkonnen officials. A sanctioned Imperial planetologist wasn't supposed to meddle in local events. He rested his hand near the weapon blade at his waist. In any event, he was ready, but hopeful that he would see no more than an extended exchange of insults, escalating threats, and perhaps a scuffle that would end in hard feelings and a few bruises. But in a moment, the character of the confrontation changed, and Kynes realized his stupidity. This was not a mere taunting game, but a deadly serious standoff. The Harkonnens were out for a kill. The six soldiers waded in, blades flashing, shields pulsing. The Freeman youths fought back. Within seconds, one of the natives was down, gushing bright, foaming blood from a severed neck artery. Kynes was about to shout, but swallowed his words as anger turned his vision red. While he'd been driving along, he had made grandiose plans of using the Freeman as a resource, a true desert people with whom he could share ideas. He had dreamed of adapting them as a grand workforce for his sparkling scheme of ecological transformation. They were to be his willing allies, enthusiastic assistants. Now these block-headed Harkonnens were, for no apparent reason, trying to kill his workers, the tools with which he intended to remake the planet. He could not let that happen. While the third member of their band lay bleeding to death on the sands, the other two Freemen, with only primitive milky blue knives and no shields, attacked in a wild frenzy that astounded Kynes. "Takwa!" they screamed. Two Harkonnens fell under the surprise rally, and their four remaining comrades were slow in coming to their aid. Hesitantly, the blue-uniformed soldiers moved toward the youths. Indignant at the Harkonnens' gross injustice, Kynes reacted on impulse. He slid toward the bravos from the rear, moving quickly and silently. Switching on his personal shield, he unsheathed the short-bladed slip tip he kept for self-defense, a shield-fighting weapon with poison in its point. During the harsh years on Seleucus Secundus, he had learned how to fight with it and how to kill. His parents had worked in one of the Imperium's most infamous prisons, and the day-to-day environments in Kynes's explorations had often required him to defend himself against powerful predators. He uttered no cry of battle, for that would have compromised his element of surprise. Kynes held his weapon low. He wasn't particularly brave, merely single-minded. As if driven by a force beyond the person who held it, the tip of Kynes's blade passed through the body shield of the nearest Harkonnen, then pushed hard and thrust upward into flesh, cartilage, and bone. The blade penetrated beneath the man's rib cage, pierced his kidneys, and severed his spinal cord. Kynes yanked out the knife and rotated halfway to his left, sliding the knife into the side of a second Harkonnen soldier, who was just turning. The shield slowed the poisoned blade for a moment, but as the Harkonnen thrashed, Kynes drove the point home, deep into the soft flesh of the abdomen, again cutting upward. Thus two Harkonnens lay mortally wounded and writhing before anyone had made an outcry. Now four of them were down, including those the Freeman had killed. The remaining pair of Harkonnen bullies stared in shock at this turn of events, then howled at the brash boldness of the tall stranger. They exchanged combat signals and spread apart, eyeing Kynes more than the Freeman, who stood ferocious and ready to fight with their fingernails if necessary. Again the Freeman lunged against their attackers. Again they screamed, "Takwa!" One of the two surviving Harkonnen soldiers thrust his sword at Kynes, but the planetologist moved rapidly now, still angry and flushed with the blooding of his first two victims. He reached upward, rippling through the shield, and neatly slit the attacker's throat. "An entrecer!" The guard dropped his sword and grasped his neck in a futile attempt to hold his lifeblood inside. The fifth Harkonnen crumpled to the ground. As the two Freeman fighters turned their revenge upon the lone remaining enemy, Kynes bent over the seriously wounded desert youth and spoke to him. "Stay calm. I will help you." The young man had already sprayed copious amounts of blood into the gravelly dust, but Kynes had an emergency med pack on his belt. He slapped a wound sealant on the ragged neck cut, then used hypovials with ready plasma and high-powered stimulants to keep the victim alive. He felt the young man's pulse at the wrist, a steady heartbeat. Kynes saw the depth of the damage now and was astonished that the youth hadn't bled more. Without medical attention, he would have died within minutes. But still, Kynes was amazed that the boy had survived this long. "This Freeman's blood coagulates with extreme efficiency." Another fact to file away in his memory. A survival adaptation to reduce moisture loss in the driest desert?
"Yeah! No!"
Kynes looked up at the cries of pain and terror. Off to one side, the Freeman had dug the surviving Harkonnen's eyes out of their sockets, using their blade tips. Then they made slow work of flaying their victim alive, stripping away ribbons of pink skin, which they stored in sealed pouches at their hips. Covered with blood, Kynes stood up, panting. Seeing their viciousness now that the tables had been turned, he began to wonder if he'd done the right thing. These Freemen were like wild animals and had worked themselves into a frenzy. Would they attempt to kill him now, despite what he had done for them? He was a complete stranger to these desperate young men. He watched and waited. And when the youths had finished with their grisly torture, he met their eyes and cleared his throat before speaking in Imperial Gaelic. "My name is Parrot Kynes, the Imperial planetologist assigned to Arrakis.